from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. In our first hour, the U.S. Supreme Court is about to take up an issue with profound implications. The question, can human genes be patented? The case involves two genetic sequences that significantly increase women's risk of breast and ovarian cancer. A lower court ruled that a biotech company in Utah could patent the genes, thus controlling their use in research and treatment. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments on both sides, and this hour we'll discuss the issues and their impact on science, medicine, and patients. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Dave Iverson. Well, on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court takes up a case that asks this fundamental question. Are genes patentable? The case involves a Utah biotech company, Myriad Genetics, which has a patent on genes known to increase the risk for breast and ovarian cancer in women. The issue pits patent lawyers and biotech companies against the American Medical Association, women's health groups, even the ACLU. And joining us this hour to discuss the issues and their implications, with me here in the studio, Lauren Sommer, who is KQED's science and environment reporter. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. Also with us here in the studio, Jeffrey Lefston. He's a professor at UC Hastings College of Law, where he teaches patent and intellectual property law, and we should also say a former molecular biologist. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Joining us by phone, Karuna Jagger. She's executive director of Breast Cancer Action, and they are one of the groups suing Myriad Genetics. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us from the Netherlands, David Koopsel, who's an author. His book is called Who Owns You? The Corporate Gold Rush to Patent Your Genes. He's also a lawyer and philosophy professor at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. Good morning to you as well. It's probably good evening to you by now, I guess, or good afternoon anyway.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Lauren Sommer. Give us a little bit of genetics 101. What does it mean to patent a gene in this case?
Yeah, and it sounds really weird. Let's just say that first, right? I mean, a gene is something we all have inside our body, right? It's a little part of DNA. It's inside our cells. It's the blueprint for what happens inside of us. So I think a lot of us have this natural reaction, which is, well, wait a second. How can you do that? What really is at issue in this case is what's being patented. So this company isn't saying, well, we own what's inside your cells. But what they're saying is we're doing something to this DNA that makes it patentable. And so what they do, you know, in some cases for genetic testing, in some cases people do it to make drugs or treatments, but they take a little section of your DNA out. They isolate the gene or a section of a gene. And so the argument is by taking out this little slice, they've processed it in a way where it's no longer something that's naturally occurring. It's something that's more man-made, and that's why they can put a patent on it.
And does it change it in some way?
Well, I mean, this is where we really get into the nitty-gritty stuff. But, the kind of interesting thing about patent law is, you know, it was written a long time ago when we patented things like light bulbs and machines and chemicals, right? And now we're looking at these other things like genes and software, these things that are not quite so easy to kind of contain. And so really the argument that's being made is still kind of based on these chemical properties. You had this long chain of DNA. You took out this little thing that became a new molecule is what the argument is.
But of course they didn't invent or discover the genes.
Yeah, so they've licensed it actually from a university that did that work. But
What about the Human Genome Project? I mean, is that, you know, that was taxpayer funded? I mean, this wasn't all private research, right?
No, I mean, this is an example of one of the really early gene patents. I think now what we've seen is patents that are a lot more narrow, right? This one patent for these two genes, which is BRCA1 and BRCA2, it gives this one company a lot of power to say what happens to those genes. Now we're actually seeing it a lot more narrow because of things like the Human Genome Project. You know, it's not quite so hard to spend millions of dollars to find a gene anymore. It used to be.
When you say it gives them the power to control what happens to the genes, what do you mean?
Yeah, and this is kind of something else that's at issue in this case. But in practical terms right now, if you are a patient and you need to get this test, we should say all of us have BRCA1 and BRCA2. And most of the time they're doing good things for us, right? They're actually preventing us from getting cancer. Some people have mutations in those genes that mean that they don't quite work correctly. And in some women, it really increases your chance of getting breast or ovarian cancer. And so if you need that test, if you need to figure out if you have those mutations, right now you have to go to Myriad Genetics to get that test because they control the patent.
And I should say we invited Myriad Genetics to be on the show. They declined to do that, not surprising given that their case is going to be heard on Monday. But they did release a statement from their corporate office which says, among other things, that without adequate intellectual property protection, companies would face significant obstacles conducting pioneering research and bringing new products to market that save lives. And I want to bring in one of the plaintiffs in this case, or at least her organization is, Karuna Jagger from Breast Cancer Action. What is it from the perspective of women with breast cancer or women who have these genes? What is it? What's the harm that you see in having a company like Myriad have a gene on these patents? Have a patent on these genes.
It's a great question. And I think, Lauren, you did a wonderful job of really laying out what the human BRCA1 and 2 genes are and what this patent entails. And what we see is that Myriad's patent is so sweeping that in practical terms, they're able to control all research on the human BRCA1 and 2 genes. This means that no other doctor, researcher, clinician, company can develop a different diagnostic test, targeted therapies. Myriad gets to control who does what research on these genes. Now, in practical terms, because of Myriad's monopoly, Myriad is able to sell an expensive and outdated test. It is the only commercially available test in the U.S. It has not been validated by the scientific community. You'd be surprised to know that the FDA does not review and approve genetic diagnostic tests. Myriad charges more than $3,000 for this test when other labs say they could do a more complete test for a few hundred dollars.
Although, as part of their statement, they do say that more than 5,000 women have received free testing and that the average out-of-pocket expense for patients is $100.
What I can tell you is there are hundreds of women who have paid, who have not been able to access the test because of the cost. We're joined by co-plaintiffs on the case, women who currently have cancer. In one woman's case, it's metastatic ovarian cancer because she couldn't get the test.
Yeah.
So let me go on to say that Myriad's, you know, as Lauren said, sometimes we all have mutations in our body. Some of these mutations on the BRCA1 and 2 genes are linked to an increased risk of cancer. Some are not. And too often, Myriad is telling women they have a mutation, but Myriad doesn't know what it means. And so it's putting women in an impossible situation. There are no second opinions, and women are faced with incredibly difficult choices to undergo increased surveillance at cost, expense, stress, or perhaps even to remove healthy organs to prevent cancer. Most of us want a second opinion when we have a dental procedure, and here women are considering removing healthy breasts and healthy ovaries in order to prevent cancer, and they can't get a second opinion.
Jeffrey Leston, I know you support the idea of patenting genes. What's the counterargument to what we've just heard?
Well, I think it's important to remember exactly what's at stake here. As Lauren says, it's about isolated and purified DNA sequences. And it's certainly true that Myriad's patents increase the cost and decrease the availability of breast cancer screening. But the premise of the patent system is that in exchange for a monopoly of limited duration, the patentee has given us some useful information about the invention. And so we accept, for example, that one can patent a pharmaceutical, which may make treatment inaccessible to patients, or one could patent a new diagnostic machine, for example. That would be the way to detect breast cancer. And generally speaking, in patent law, we accept that temporary trade-off, that the patentee gets a temporary monopoly, because we view the incentives offered by the patent system as important in getting these technical developments. Now, the case of gene patents, though, is particularly difficult because historically, it's probably true that we didn't need gene patents in order to get that research because we had the publicly funded Genome Project, which had its objective dumping all this information into the public domain without patents. Now, to some extent, that was spurred by trying to prevent other people from getting patents, so the patent system did accelerate that discovery. But this is a particular case, one of the few unique cases where we can be confident that patents may not have been necessary in order to get that innovation.
Is there an argument that, like the Human Genome Project, that perhaps you know, research of this nature should be open source?
I think there is a strong argument. So the question that the court is facing, though, is this the proper case and this the proper instrument in order to promote those policies? And is the court the proper actor? So what the court will be deciding in this case is whether human genes, and probably more generally isolated natural products, are even within the boundaries of the patent system. Are these even potentially patentable subject matter? Because patent law has other requirements that an invention has to meet before it can be patentable. It has to be novel, non-obvious, useful, et cetera.
And is there some precedent there that will guide them?
Well, the precedent is difficult. People have actually been patenting isolated natural products since the 1870s. I think in 1873, Louis Pasteur got a patent for an isolated yeast. And people have been patenting purified hormones and things like that since the early 20th century. The court recently has decided a case last year called Mayo versus Prometheus, where it emphasized that the only judicial exclusions from patentable subject matter are abstract ideas, natural laws, and natural phenomena. None of these are set out in the patent statute, but the court has articulated a longstanding exception. So if the court rules that human genes are not patent-eligible subject matter, it will very likely be on the grounds that they are either natural laws or natural phenomena. But one of the questions is this the decision that the court should be making, or is this a policy matter left to Congress? I think it's worth noting that in 1993 and in 2007, Congress considered legislation that would prevent gene patents, and that was rejected. And 2 years ago, when Congress extensively overhauled the patent laws, they specifically included a provision to prevent a patent on human beings, but declined to include a ban on gene patents. And so one of the issues facing the court will be, do they want to judicially legislate in this area, or is this a decision better left to Congress?
David Kopsel, let me bring you into this. So what would you add to what Karuna Jagger said earlier about the impact of this current, the status quo, in this case, these gene sequences being patented by Myriad?
Well, I think one of the most important things she mentioned already is the fact that the monopoly limits the access that people have to a second opinion in this case with the BRCA1 and 2 genes. Other companies have not been as tight with their patents and have allowed licensing of their patents so that there is some competition in other gene patents. But in the case of the BRCA1 and 2 genes, there is no such competition, and therefore the price remains a monopolistic price. And I believe that at this point, Myriad has recouped its costs many times over.
But that you can say that about pharmaceuticals, too.
Yeah, and I would say it about many pharmaceuticals. So much of the R&D that goes into developing life-saving drugs is actually started and done with public expenditures and then later commercialized and developed into drugs. But setting that aside, I think it's important to mention that Dr. Lefston has mentioned that there's some exceptions to what is patentable. The abstract ideas, laws of nature, and natural phenomena. Well, these exceptions have been noted by the court for quite some time. It's not like they suddenly invented them. Back in 1980, when the court was faced with the question of whether you could get a patent on a life form in the Chakrabarty case, the Supreme Court reiterated that there are some exceptions, including laws of nature, physical phenomena, and abstract ideas. And as Dr. Lefston points out, this is going to really come down to whether or not isolation of these sequences, of the nucleotide strings bearing those sequences, is really just the reiteration of some physical phenomenon.
Lawrence Sommer, we are here in the cradle of innovation, as we like to say, in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, and the whole Bay Area region. A lot of very creative biotech companies, software companies. How do they see this case, do you think? What's at stake for them?
Yeah, and I think a lot is at stake, but of course it depends on how narrowly or how broadly the court rules. I mean, in the course of kind of reporting on this, I talked to Genentech, right? They're one of the largest in the world. They were one of the first here in the Bay Area. They told me it's not like their business model is going to completely fall apart if the court rules broadly. There's certainly the patents.
Broadly meaning?
you know, invalidating all gene, these, you know, exactly, some very broad ruling. Because, you know, obviously companies are very careful to patent lots of things, right? Not just this little genetic sequence, but also if they're making something with it, whether it's a drug or a treatment, they're patenting the other steps in that process. What they did tell me was, you know, this is the basis for the biotech industry. They've been built on these gene patents. So it does have the potential to shake things up a little bit.
And what about like software companies? Do they have a dog in this fight?
Not on the gene patents, but I think it brings up a really interesting issue because patent law, you know, it was made for things like light bulbs and machines, these very tangible things. And we're kind of seeing it really being pushed to its limits now with things like software, intellectual property, genes, that type of subject matter.
That's Lauren Sommer, KQED's science and environment reporter. She's joining us this hour along with Karuna Jagger from Breast Cancer Action, Jeffrey Lefson, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, where he teaches patent and intellectual property law, and David Kopsel, who has written the book, Who Owns You? The Corporate Gold Rush to Patent Your Genes. We're talking about this case before the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday involving the patenting of genes. Back to you, Professor Lefson. You know, the court is sometimes some of the issues that come before the court. Gay marriage was there just a few weeks ago, and a lot of issues break down ideologically. Does this issue fit into that pattern at all? Is there an ideological way to look at this?
Typically, no. Intellectual property issues that are before the Supreme Court certainly don't follow the usual 5-4 ideological split that we see in the court. Certainly, certain justices have certain positions. Justice Breyer, for example, very skeptical of patents in this field. In copyright, Justice Ginsburg is a copyright hawk. But it really doesn't break down under along particular lines. The factors that may come into play here are some concerns about unsettling investments. A lot of companies, as Lauren mentioned, have used these sort of patents as the foundation for their investments, so which has not really been an issue before. So the court, to the extent it's concerned about upsetting people's investments, may tread with caution. And again, I think the real ideological position that might influence the court is how willing is the court to tread where Congress has not gone? Do they view this as a realm in which they should be making these policy decisions, or should it be left to the legislative, the political sphere?
And what about the so-called originalists, you know, like Clarence Thomas and Scalia? I mean, do they have to look back to the framers' intentions around something like this?
Well, the only knowledge we have about the framers is that in the Patent and Copyright Clause of the Constitution tells us that Congress has the power to grant patents to inventors for their discoveries to promote the progress of the useful arts. And of course, in the early days of the Republic, people were patenting things like new plows, later on steam engines, and so forth. So I think the court will look back to that general constitutional purpose of patent law to promote the progress of useful arts. And that's been used in the past to require that patents be novel or non-obvious. But certainly in the realm of copyright, the court has given Congress very free rein to exercise its own judgment about how to promote the progress of science. And so I suspect that they may well decide to defer to Congress in this sphere as well.
Karuna Jagger, you're one of the plaintiffs, and one of the others is the American Civil Liberties Union. They were one of I believe they filed that original lawsuit back in 2009. You're not a lawyer, I understand, but what is your understanding of why the ACLU is involved in this?
Yeah, so the ACLU represents us as a plaintiff on this case. And, you know, many of the issues have been raised already, but in simple terms, patents are generally allowable for inventions and not discoveries. And so we believe that Myriad's argument that the act of isolating the gene is an inventive process is wrong. We believe that Myriad has basically patented a discovery, which is the human BRCA1 and 2 genes. You can extract coal. That doesn't give you the right to patent coal. Nonetheless, a company could patent methodology, device, technology, I think looking at the human body, taking out the liver or isolating a blood enzyme doesn't mean it's patentable. Nonetheless, and that doesn't stop research. That doesn't stop progress. Because Myriad's patent is so sweeping and because Myriad is so uniquely litigious, what we see is a worst-case scenario of human gene patents. We see how bad it can get when one company is controlling all access to these human genes.
I'm sorry to cut you off. To come back to this, the ACLU, the civil liberties point of this, David Kopsal, do you see this as a civil rights issue or a civil liberties issue in any way?
I think I do see an angle that in which it is it's at least an issue of broader civil rights. Specifically, I think there's something I think called the scientific commons, which we talk about, basically the realm of knowledge that science seeks to uncover. And that's, I believe, behind this exception that the Supreme Court has carved out, the laws of nature, physical phenomenon, and abstract ideas. So what we're really talking about with this case, and it will have implications in other cases where isolation has been found to make something inventive, is whether or not merely identifying something in nature and isolating it from its surrounding environment in some way is really enough to take it out of the scientific commons and then put it into the hands of some commercial or other entity so that it's no longer accessible to us to use as we wish. And that is an issue of, I believe, civil rights.
Jeffrey Lefson, what would you add to that?
Well, I think that may be overstating the case a little bit, because it's not true that a patent on a gene prevents all research on the gene. It certainly prevents people from making, using, or selling the isolated DNA. Now, there is, in theory at least, in patent law, a research exemption that purely intellectual exploration of a patented invention is not considered patent infringement. Unfortunately, the lower courts have tended to interpret that exception extremely narrowly. But if our concern is really about patents inhibiting research, and that is the concern that the Supreme Court has articulated in several of its cases, it seems to me that it would be much wiser to have a more robust research exemption to say that these things are not infringement, rather than to say an entire category of subject matter can never be within the bounds of the patent system.
Yeah, Lauren?
Yeah, one of the kind of other interesting angles to this case is, obviously there's no like instruction book that comes with our DNA. The only way we find out if these mutations are harmful or not is by looking at a whole bunch of genetic data, a lot of genetic tests. What Myriad's been doing is they've been kind of keeping that database a few years ago, they started keeping that database of information secret. And so what some researchers have been arguing is, while basic research may not be a problem, not being able to have access to this database to see, let's look at these 1,000 people. Did this mutation cause a big problem? That is a research question that a lot of people are having problems with, because they feel like that's something that could really help the greater good.
And Jeffrey Lefson, earlier you said, well, maybe this isn't really this shouldn't be decided by judges. It should be decided by Congress, which, of course, raises all kinds of issues in and of itself. But, to what extent do judges have the or do they need the scientific training? I mean, you are a former molecular biologist, but, the 9 justices on the Supreme Court are not.
The scientific training, I think, generally lets you see through the science to understand what's really at issue here. So we're addressing really fundamental questions about, can you patent something that you purify from nature? And that's really more or less the question at the heart of this case, which might be clouded in a lot of scientific rhetoric, but it's really not a scientific issue. And it's basic questions about in what human spheres we think the patent system should intrude or not. So I think as long as the court can see enough of the science to understand the real underlying issues, we'll be okay.
All right. We're going to continue talking about this case before the Supreme Court on Monday. And if you'd like to join us, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. And you can also leave a message, comment, or question on our Facebook page as well. Scott Schaefer here today for Dave Iverson. Much more to come. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Dave Iverson. In this hour, we're talking about a case before the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday. It's formerly known as the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. It involves a patenting question of two gene sequences associated with increased risk for breast and ovarian cancer. Joining us this hour, Lauren Sommer is our KQED Public Radio science and environment reporter. Also with me in the studio, Jeffrey Lefston, a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, where he teaches patent and intellectual property law. And joining us from the Netherlands, where he teaches, it's David Koopsal. He's the author of Who Owns You? The Corporate Gold Rush to Patent Your Genes. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we invite you to call. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And let's go to the phones. Walnut Creek, Mandy is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. I was part of some of the original BRCA1 and 2 research at the university. Specifically, we were looking at psychosocial issues related to genetic testing for breast cancer. I've also had family members have the testing. And I'll just come out and say I oppose, I also have patent attorneys in my family. I oppose the right to patent the gene sequence. And I know when I was working, I was never consulted about or informed that my labor would be eventually used for the private financial benefit of, you know, a private company. The women who we worked with who were part of the testing, I don't believe that it was part of their informed consent that the information garnered from their participation would later become privately owned and in a way that would charge researchers, future researchers, and testees large amounts of money. And so I really question the ethics of all of this, and it makes me think of other scientists I know who have admitted that tissue taken from people, you know, under one rubric or for one purpose has been used without their knowledge, let alone consent for other purposes. And I want to know, where do the ethics come in on this in terms of the people who originally worked on the research, the people who gave their tissue and their time, and, you know, they're dealing with cancer here.
Yeah, yeah, it's obviously a very personal issue, especially you know, if when these genes run in families, as I think they tend to do. Jeffrey Lefston, what's your take on the ethical questions here?
Well, I admit I'm not a bioethicist here, so those are generally handled, you know, at the university level. Each university might have policies about the use of samples or the rights of people who work on an invention to the patents in the end. But I think it's true. These are very salient issues. They're not really an issue in the case, which, again, is whether these things are really in the bounds of the patent system. But I think these are very serious concerns.
Yeah. David Koopsal, more broadly, what do you see as ethical questions here that the justices should keep in mind,
if any? I think that the caller points to a very important point. One is that there are people who took part in this study who helped Myriad and other organizations to identify these genes, who I believe were engaged in basic science, and there were many research groups at the same time who were looking for these genes. And that basic science then gets wrapped up and monopolized by one party for financial gain. And I'd look back at what the Supreme Court said about those exclusionary topics. They said in the Funk Brothers case that such discoveries, such as the law of E equals MC squared or the law of gravity, are, quote, manifestations of nature, free to all men and reserved exclusively to none. And this really is the ethical base of what's at stake in this case. Are these mutations, which we've discovered, and were discovered in many places almost simultaneously, free to all men, or are they going to be reserved exclusively to a particular company? That is a huge ethical dilemma at the center of this case.
Yeah.
And will have implications for other similar research programs.
Mandy, the caller, just let me ask you, do you feel, what about the argument that Myriad makes that, if it weren't for the patent, that they wouldn't have made the sort of discoveries that they have, the tests that are available, and, all these other things?
You know, there are people I am close to in my life who work in the intellectual property field, and I have to tell you, I just don't buy it. It's the same argument. Every company who challenges, who tries to defend a patent makes the exact same argument. And we look at other countries who have different kinds of laws. They still do engage in research. And, I think it needs to be balanced with the fact that many of us contributed our labor, like I said, our tissue, our time, our energy, our faith in the system. We're not informed that.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously a very, very personal issue in that sense. But you raise a good question or a good point. And David Kopsal, you're in Europe. How does Europe look at these issues differently than the United States does or the European Union?
They're much tougher in enforcing a research exemption. So, as was pointed out earlier, there's often a sort of tacit acceptance of a research exception, so researchers can go about what they're doing in the lab typically without having to worry about getting sued. Myriad has been tougher with that than other companies, but Europe in general has a very broad research exemption, and very few companies would dare try to shut down basic research in order to enforce their patents.
Jeffrey Lefson.
It is worthwhile to point out that most other countries do regard DNA sequences as patentable. A European Commission directive in 1998 specifically mandated that isolated biological materials be patentable. They're patentable in Japan. There is a recent case in Australia on very similar patents, the counterparts to Myriad's patents, and the federal court there ruled that those genes were patentable.
Yeah. Lauren?
I think this does really bring up an interesting issue, which is, take the University of California. They're one of the top 10 patent holders, gene patent holders in the country, publicly funded research. And so I think, from what I've heard, from what people have been telling me, there has been a progression where universities have been a lot more careful not to lock up rights in one company when they do licenses, making sure that there's sub-licensing in there, that their research exemptions are much clearer. So I think there has been an evolution in terms of some universities.
All right, Mandy, thanks so much for the call. Let's go now to Martha's Vineyard. Anthony is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's going on?
My question was with say Monsanto and how they're able to patent genes, and then their crops or the seeds that they have generated go into a foreign crop, and therefore they can then claim the rights to that DNA sequence and then therefore also own that farmer. Same thing with a person. If they take this DNA and then they take it and I'm assuming injected into someone and shut down that gene sequence to kill the cancer, then the woman then has a child. Does that company therefore then own the child DNA in some kind of way? I mean,
Jeffrey Lefson.
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to differentiate patents from ownership. We often conflate the two. But even if I had, say, a patent on a human being, which I can't by statute, that would simply allow me to prevent other people from making, using, or selling that engineered human being. I wouldn't own that human being. And there are plenty of people, millions of people, walking around right now with patented inventions being part of their body. Anyone who has a hip replacement or a pacemaker is probably carrying around patented technology and, at least in theory, infringing the patent by the act of walking or living.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for the call, Anthony. We've got some email here. Let me read a couple of them. One listener, Henrietta, writes, Henrietta Lacks' cells were stolen in 1951. The HeLa cells were sold for many years and her family didn't receive money. Is this the same issue? Jeffrey Lesson, are you familiar with that?
I am. This refers to a cell line that's been used in research for, I think, over 60 years, the HeLa cells, which were originally obtained from Henrietta Lacks. And again, this was back in the 50s, I think well before we were thinking about these things.
No, again, it was a cancerous tumor that she had.
It was. And so that cell line is still propagated today. So again, this goes to the question of should patients who are the source of either a particular gene or a particular cell line, should they receive some sort of compensation for uses of their material?
Daniel writes, genes are an intrinsic part of a living being. Someone who tries to patent my arm is violating my person and my civil rights. Patenting the machinery that builds that arm is a deep violation of my rights to my person. Christopher writes, a patent that gives DNA ownership could be a financial, if not sociological or medical disaster, should it happen that cures cannot be developed by real innovators because some company is sitting on a patent and doing nothing with it. You know, in its amicus brief, Jeffrey Lufsten, the AMA, I believe it was the AMA, calls this a matter of national urgency. Do you see the stakes as being that great?
I actually don't. I mean, for one thing, we've had these gene patents for over 30 years now. I mean, in some ways, it's very odd the case is arising now because the great majority of these patents have either expired or will be expiring in the next couple of years, such as Myriad's patents, for example. So we have had DNA patents for 30 years, and we have still gotten cures.
And we should say, too, the two lower courts ruled in Myriad's favor, correct?
Actually, the district court ruled against Myriad. The intermediate appellate court, the Federal Circuit, on the gene sequence claims ruled against Myriad. It is important to point out, however, that they did invalidate a potentially much broader patent, which was to the process of basically screening a patient or a tumor for BRCA mutations.
Yeah.
One question in this case is, does the gene patent actually matter? Because modern diagnostic and screening technologies don't necessarily have to use the isolated DNA sequence to sequence the BRCA gene.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Daniel in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I was wondering, it seems like there's a difference here between isolating something from nature and isolating something from a person. That if I make a novel tomato through genetic, transgenetic operation, that's one thing. But part of like a person, like a living person, it seems like you shouldn't be able to go to the baseline and patent that. That there's a distinction between sort of agriculture and a individual human being.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Lauren. How do you think companies like, Genentech, do they see that a distinction there, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, their argument is, you know, if we're going to develop a drug that uses some information from a genetic sequence, it takes us $1 billion. It takes us decades. And so they would say, you know, we need to be able to make those types of investments. We need some protection to do that. I mean, there have been drugs that have been developed that have been very effective kind of based on some of these genetic sequences. But I think there's just really interesting issues being brought up because it's inside us, right? We feel this kind of personal connection to this information.
David Kopsall, do you see a difference between, say, crops and cancer? Or human genes and the genetics of corn?
Well, yeah, I do, actually. I think there's a difference between when you've engineered something, when you've created something transgenic, which hasn't existed in nature before, and when you've merely isolated something that does exist in nature, like the sequence that nature devised that causes or tends to cause cancers. There's a significant difference. I think if the patent system is going to serve the purposes of promoting innovation, it should be able to encourage people to create new things, things that haven't existed before. But if basic science is going to proceed, then the limit for where patents go should be at discovery. So you shouldn't get a patent for something you discover in nature because you're not creating something new.
Jeffrey Lefson.
One thing to point out, I think it will be very difficult doctrinally for the court to rule that only, say, human genes are unpatentable. If it rules against them, it will probably be on the broader ground that all isolated and purified natural substances will be unpatentable. So someone, for example, who isolates a new pharmaceutical from snake venom or something like that, or a new enzyme from bacteria, will probably not be able to patent that if Myriad loses.
All right. Daniel, thanks so much for the call. Let's go now to Oakland. Johan, welcome.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. And fantastic discussion. I just had 2 points I wanted to hear your guest comments on. The recent court ruling in India, I think that was a smack in the face for Genentech, I believe. I wonder if that has any bearing on the subsequent ruling. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I think David Kopsall is asking if you mean Novartis.
Oh, okay, certainly. And the other question was the sunsetting provision, how, you know, pharma companies, you know, towards the end of life will actually make minor adjustments or changes to keep that patent alive and then, you know, keeping a stranglehold on that of your service.
Yeah. David Kopsall, you want to comment?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting case, and it does point to one of the shortcomings of the patent system in that it actually encourages a lot of these big successful pharmaceutical companies, I believe, to make
rather incremental changes on blockbuster drugs rather than do sort of blue sky research, because the potential for return on investment is much greater if you can just tweak the molecule a little bit enough to get a new patent and get a monopoly on something you already know more or less works. And I believe this actually is one of the weaknesses of the of relying on the, this system as the primary mechanism for generating funds for R&D. It's also worth noting that currently there has been some studies that show that only about 1.3% of the profits that Big Pharma makes on its products go back into basic R&D, whereas about 25% go into marketing.
Jeffrey Lefson.
I agree we should be incentivizing more blockbuster fundamental discoveries than tweaks to existing drugs. But you have to realize that when we deny patentability to fundamental discoveries, we are in fact encouraging people to spend their money on new tweaks. I talk to people at biotech companies who say, well, given the direction the Supreme Court has already gone, our basic discoveries are not going to be patentable, so we're going to direct our efforts toward some new ways of measuring a known quantity because we're sure that's patentable. So when we're making these decisions about patents, we're really making decisions about where we want people to be investing.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Pengrove. Richard is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. And the gentleman starts to make my point for me. I wanted to introduce an old-fashioned idea, and that is one of corporate citizenry, not one of corporations as personhood, which they enjoy legally. But that also raises a question that if, in fact, the idea is always for profit, the idea is always it costs us money, therefore we will only do this kind of profit-making research, and I'm sure there are examples of amounts that are non-profit, but the point being the direction of science sent only by profit rules out the idea that these corporations which enjoy personhood can't be satisfied by simply being responsible citizens and giving to the world good.
Well, David Kopsall, interesting point. But I mean, there is still a lot of basic research going on at the university level, corporate level as well, I imagine.
Yeah, more than half of the drugs that actually get approved begin, actually, it's about 80% of the drugs that actually get approved in every year start as basic publicly funded research. And then at some point, a corporation invests in drug development. So, there, you know, to maintain this balance, I think we need to, and this balance might be on the line given the current financial crisis as well, we need to decide what we're going to keep in the realm of science and what we should allow in the realm of technology. And I think this case stands to make an impact in you know, where we draw the line.
What do you mean by the current financial crisis and the impact of that?
Well, with the cutbacks to basic research, which are already going on, it's likely that there's going to be less R&D at the upstream end, at the in the basic science end.
Yeah. All right, Richard, thanks very much for that call. 866-733-6786 is the number to call if you want to join us this morning. Let's go now to Jesse in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I'm not sure of the exact name, but in the mobile phone industry, there are certain essential technologies that the patent holders, I think they're called FRAN patents, that the patent holders are required to license for reasonable fees. Could something like that be applied to this?
Jeffrey Lefson?
Well, in the industry, you're right that there's an obligation to license essential patents at fair and reasonable rates. Though that derives, however, from the companies that own those patents participating in standard setting. So a company that owns a patent helps build the wireless standard. It then has an obligation to license those patents at reasonable rates. But certainly that, I think, is one solution which you could explore. I mean, the thing about human genes is they're singular. You can't really invent around a human gene in one case. So I think there's a strong case to be made that there should or should have been some sort of mandatory or compulsory licensing scheme for human genes.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jesse, for the call. Some email here. Michael writes, what do your guests think about the historic notion of the public trust doctrine, where the state holds certain things in trust for the benefit of the public for public use? There are some things that are so important for public use they can't be treated as private property. Aren't genetic codes a public trust in a knowledge economy? David Kopsall?
Yeah, okay, so there's something called merchant rights, and Dr. Lefton can correct me if I'm wrong because I'm not a patent attorney. But in the case of a sufficiently important invention that is patentable, then the government could exercise merchant rights and basically make it available to competitors. Is that more or less correct?
That's certainly correct for typically inventions that were funded with federal dollars, say NIH research. The government retains the theoretical power to practice the invention. That power has never been exercised. It's much more
right.
a political
and so
question.
Right, that's the sticking point, you know. And it's interesting that in this case, the Solicitor General has come down on this, has drafted an amicus that more or less supports the plaintiffs, and yet the government hasn't exercised its merchant rights. So they're not willing to go that far, but they are willing to make to state an opinion and urge the court to rule for the plaintiffs.
Yeah, if depending on how the court rules, I mean, is this an impact not only on the companies and on the parties to this case, but is it Jeffrey Lefton? Is it the patent office that basically has to follow whatever the court orders?
It certainly does, and one of the important questions is how will the court rule? You know, the case is probably about setting a dividing line between discovery and patentable invention. And how the court draws that line is going to be very critical. Frankly, given the court's more recent cases, they're not going to be very specific, I would imagine. And it will be left with a period of confusion and uncertainty, which we're currently in, for example, for software. And the lower courts and the patent office will have to hash that out over the next couple of years.
And Lauren Sommer, is it your sense that biotech companies, for example, would like something much more clear? I mean, they want to know what the rules of the road are.
I'm guessing businesses would always say that, yeah. I mean, I think one other interesting thing to bring up is, you know, kind of in the early days of genetic research, we tended to think one gene, one disease. There was this kind of very simple relationship. And now we're looking at much more complex analysis where we're looking at multiple genes and how it affects things. And so I think for both biotech companies and just basic researchers, you know, these patents are going into a whole new world where we're looking across many, many genes. And that's a whole nother issue to bring up.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Angela in San Francisco, you're next.
Yeah, hello. I want to bring this back actually to women's health and specifically breast cancer, because these, after all, are the patents on the BRCA genes that we're talking about. And all this talk about expanding research exemptions doesn't do it for women with breast cancer right now. That's women with breast cancer, at risk for breast cancer. You know, we need to do something. It's a patented test. It's too expensive, the results are inconclusive, and it's a monopoly on a test that does jack for women who, you know, who need something to move this move progress on ending and addressing this epidemic now.
Lauren Sommer, it's not a science question. It's in some ways a health advocacy question or women's rights question.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's what's really interesting is this kind of interpretation of the test. I think that's where we're really seeing the heart of this issue. Certainly cost, certainly second opinions are very, very key. But also, you know, they need to be able to tell people, right? That's the goal, right? To tell them what these mutations mean, right? You want to know that as a patient. And so having that research out in the public, that's one of the arguments for kind of broadening that.
And David Kopsa, to what extent do you think Angela's points about what women need should be a part of what the justices consider?
Well, I think she makes an important point. This particular patent does have a disproportionate effect on women, although men who have this mutation can also get breast cancers. But I think there's this broad question of whether or not we're just going to tolerate this sort of patent in the future, and her concerns will be addressed if the court decides, as the district court decided, that these genes are simply products of nature. They belong to us and not to some corporation.
Jeffrey Lefton, what would you add to that?
I would say, though, exclusions from the patent system are a very blunt instrument for promoting women's health. I mean, there are certainly much larger questions here about access to affordable health care and so forth, but I think those go well beyond the patent system. Again, I do note that Congress has acted in certain cases where they've perceived a problem. So, for example, when people were worried about surgeons being sued for performance of patented surgical methods, Congress added a specific exception to the patent laws to say a surgeon could not be liable. So if we think it's of critical national importance that women have access to these tests, I think, again, it would be better for Congress to act or to provide some means for subsidizing these tests than excluding genes from patentability.
All right, Angela, thanks so much for the call. Let's see if we can sneak one more caller in here. We'll go to San Diego. Ashwin is on the line. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I had a quick question regarding gene patent pools as a possibility of finding a happy medium between these two sides in this argument. I don't know if there's a compulsory way of establishing these pools, but it would still solve the royalty argument while at the same time allowing for, the type of access that we've come to expect with public funded research. Thank you.
Jeff Lesson, what do you think?
There is apparently an organization which actually grew out of the patent pools for the video compression patents. So the MPEG-LA organization claims to have actually a patent pool of some 400 gene patents. So a diagnostic lab and so forth can easily get a license to a large number of gene patents from a single source. Doesn't work in the case of Myriad since they want to be the exclusive provider of BRCA testing.
All right, Ashwin, thanks very much. So these arguments will be happening on Monday morning. What are you going to be looking for, David Kopsall, first you? What are you going to – I don't know how carefully you're watching it or if you're going to go read the transcripts afterwards, but what's going to pique your interest?
Well, I'll be interested when the justices start to allude to the recent Mayo Prometheus case. It was during – it was after the court decided that case, which had to do with a diagnostic method – that they said, listen, we're not going to hear your appeal yet in the Myriad case, and they sent it back to the circuit court of the Federal Circuit to say, listen, keep this in mind, this Mayo case we just decided, and reconsider what you just did. And the court did exactly what it did before. So I'm pretty interested in how the Supreme Court is going to react to that, how it will draw attention to what it stated in Mayo and Prometheus, and I think that'll give us a clue as to whether they think the circuit court got it right.
All right, and we'll find out just exactly what they think, presumably by the end of June. Thanks to all of our guests and to our callers and listeners this hour. David Kopsall, author of Who Owns You? The Corporate Gold Rush to Patent Your Genes. Thanks also to Jeffrey Lefson from UC Hastings College of the Law, our own Lauren Sommer, our science and environment reporter, and earlier in the hour, Karuna Jagger from Breast Cancer Action. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.